I'm Judith Schneider. I'm the president and current executive director of the Association for Union Democracy. And on behalf of the Association for Union Democracy and our co-sponsors for this event, the Graduate Center's Center for Urban Studies and WBAI's Building Bridges, which is recording this event for possible broadcast on the radio and over the internet, we welcome you today. We wanted to bring together, this is really just a preliminary because we have a very tight schedule. We wanted to bring together people in this field who've had experience with government efforts at reform and rank and file efforts for reform. And Herman Benson will very shortly tell you why we thought this was necessary to do. And we're hoping, we're thinking that perhaps this may be the first of many conferences of this type to have an ongoing assessment of really what has been going on to bring about reform in the labor movement. But I want to tell you something about the schedule. We have a very full schedule, and therefore we've scheduled the principal question and discussion period for the last session, which will commence about 3:30. We have a brief question period scheduled for after this morning's session, and Ed Steers and Jim Jacobs have very kindly agreed to stay on a little bit because it's not they're not necessarily able to stay for the full session, so they will stay on for some additional questions after the morning session. But what I would ask is if you have general questions and general comments, we will have a session after the afternoon speakers have made their presentations for you to do that. And we'd ask you to jot them down, and we'll try to address all of them at that time and give everybody an opportunity to say what he or she has to say. That afternoon session, I just should tell you, will start at 1:15. But before I turn it over to Ben, I just want to make a note in my capacity as the president of AUD. And that is, we need everybody to think about, while they're listening to these presentations, whether they think what AUD is doing here and has done over the last 35 years is worthwhile. Because if you do think so, if that's your conclusion, I have to tell you that AUD operates on a shoestring, and that shoestring is becoming very, very frayed. We need all the help we can get. So I'm asking all of you to keep that in mind. Now I'd like to introduce Herman Benson. Most of you already know Herman. He's the founder of AUD, the editor of Union Democracy Review, the author of Rebels, Reformers, and Racketeers, a history of rank-and-file efforts, about which no one knows more than Herman Benson. Herman?
So let me begin by explaining just why we're here, because if you come expecting some new exposés about outrageous examples of union corruption, you're doomed to be disappointed, because we're not really here to expose corruption. We're here because we want to do something to eradicate corruption. And for that, we want to summarize the experiences of those who have been battling inside the labor movement. Corruption is not the only problem, of course not. But it is a problem. It is a very serious problem, and that's why we address ourselves to it. Those who are trying to fight against corruption in the labor movement and talk about it are not trying to tear down the labor movement. They're really trying to strengthen it and build up the labor movement. And so we're bringing together a wide range of people who had experience in battling corruption. First of all, there's Ed Steer here. I think he's had a wider and longer experience than any other human being. I think he's been at it, really, he may not realize it, for something like 20 years. starting with Local 560 of the Teamsters, where he was armed with the powers of government as a trustee, and he helped transform that from a racket-ridden union to at least a decent, regular, ordinary, bona fide union. There's Jim Jacobs here, who's been, worked for the Organized Crime Task Force of Governor Cuomo's Organized Task Force on Corruption in the Construction Industry, and he's made a study of all the government experiences under the RICO statute in battling racketeers in the union. And then I'm here, I think I've been working with union reformers for, I'd say, maybe 40 years now, with union reformers in practically every major union in the United States, and I can tell you something about their experiences. And then in the afternoon session, you're going to hear from people who've really been on the front lines of this thing for many years. I mean, rank and file unionists and workers' rights attorneys who've been in unions trying to do something about corrupt and racketeer mob-driven unions. So you're going to get a whole range of experience, except one thing. There's one missing element here that you may have noticed, and that is we don't have a representative of a single labor union leader who's been doing anything about battling against corruption. And I must say that in figuring out a list of speakers for this conference, we couldn't think of a single labor union leader to invite who would be someone who would speak about what they did at the summit of the labor movement to get rid of corruption. We couldn't think of one. And that, by the way, that's not because they don't want to do anything about corruption. Don't get me wrong. I mean, any halfway decent labor leader, if they could press the delete button on their computer and abolish all corruption and racketeering in the labor movement, they would all rush to press that button. So they would like somehow or other to get rid of corruption, but they don't want to do anything about it. And that's because it's sort of not the thing to do. You make too many enemies. If you start here, who knows where it's going to end up. But I must say, it's not that they've never done anything about corruption. There are unions and union leaders who have gotten rid of corrupt other officials, but they never do it openly. They'll sort of sidle out, sort of smoothly get rid of a corrupt union official, find some pretext or other. They didn't file the right papers or something, whatever it may be. They would sort of sidle them out, give them a golden parachute, have a banquet, endorsing their great services to the labor movement, but they're really getting rid of them because they're a bunch of corrupt leaders. That's the way they do it, and that's why we can't have any recognized labor leader here to tell you about what they've done about corruption, although I will say they have done something about corruption. So we can't really depend upon, unfortunately, we cannot depend upon the leaders of the labor movement to really do anything significant in any campaign to get rid of crooks. Now you'll inevitably hear about some of these scandals in the session that's going to come by people who have been involved in these situations. They can't tell you what they've been doing without talking about the corruption in their unions, of course. But I must mention one outstanding current example, and that's in the Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 1181, that represents school bus drivers in New York City, where the leaders of that local have now pleaded guilty to charges of corruption involving organized crime domination of their union. And despite the fact that there have been petitions from hundreds of members of that union and public protests from at least 100, let's just say, public leaders, including one congressman, The president of that union, Warren George, has not done anything to get rid of these crooks. That would be okay almost, except the fact that when he was asked to do something about the crooks in 1181, he had an article in the International Magazine praising their great services to the labor movement. So that sort of is one of the outrageous examples of the inability of leaders on the top to do something about an outrageous case of corruption in the labor movement. So if we can't talk about, if we can't expect help from the top, we can look to, and we have been looking to, at least two other forces. One of them is the rank-and-file reformers, the insurgents throughout the labor movement, who from below have been trying to do something about the mob and racketeers and democracy in their unions. The other is the force of the government, which has had a long campaign against organized crime in the labor movement and elsewhere. So first of all, let's think about the insurgent movements in the labor movement. We at AUD have been working with union reformers throughout the labor movement for at least 40 years. And we know that they are there. We know that they are there because we've met them, and some of them are sitting right here in this hall, just a few. There are hundreds of them, people who have courageously been battling in their local unions. And actually, we've been in touch with, if not hundreds, if you want to consider the groups and caucuses and slates that have run in unions, there are probably thousands, if not tens of thousands of people out there seated throughout the labor movement who have been concerned with this problem. The problem is that wherever a union is dominated by an unscrupulous group of autocrats, or especially organized crime mob figures, the insurgents face an absolutely insuperable problem of raw power. I mean, if you can criticize the President of the United States, and nobody's going to bother you too much, but if you criticize your business agent and your corrupt business manager, you don't work. If you try to run for office, you can't get on the ballot. If you get on the ballot box is stuffed. And if you keep at it, I'm talking now about this kind of union, you don't work. Sometimes you get beaten, or if you're in luck, you simply get expelled for troublemaking. Now, I'm not trying to indict the entire labor movement. Remember, I want to make that clear. I'm talking about those really hard and fast, real problems of organized crime or arrantly dictatorial and unscrupulous labor leaders. So in frustration, many of these unionists, they go everywhere looking for help. They go to their congressmen, they go to their priests, they go to the NLRB, they go to the Department of Labor, they go to incompetent or semi-competent lawyers, searching always somewhere for someone that's going to do the job for them, usually in vain. We know about these people because very often the National Labor Relations Board or the Department of Labor or some other government agency which cannot do anything or will not do anything for these workers, they refer them to AUD. Now, can you imagine that? The United States government with a multi-trillion dollar deficit, a multi-trillion dollar debt, with an army in Iraq and in Afghanistan, this huge United States government will send people to AUD where there are 2.5 people working in a little office to solve their problem. But that is the reality of it. Now, these people need help. They need help. And they're desperate to help. You sit in our office, and you get an unbalanced view of humanity, just like maybe a cop does in sitting in his precinct office, where people come with all these sordid problems. You got to guard against getting a poisoned view of the world, because people are coming to us by the hour with problems all over the place. You ask Kurt Richwerger, who's the only one who's there in the office full time right now, all the time, who just goes crazy trying to answer all these problems. Now, we try to do what we can. And we do. We do help. And they need help from civil libertarians. They need help from workers' rights attorneys, like some of you sitting out there. And they get help from AUD. But I regret to say that what we can do is very limited. They need far more help than we can give them. They need the help against organized crime and racketeers. They need the help from the power of government. They need the help from law. They need the help from the courts. They need the help from law enforcement authorities. And no racketeer should be exempt from that kind of scrutiny because they can hide behind the union label. There should be no cover of a union label for organized crime or racketeering or even errant, unscrupulous labor leaders in the labor movement. Now, for 20 years, there's been a vigorous effort by the government, law enforcement agencies, against organized crime in the labor movement. And by the way, this is not an effort that's directed just against the labor movement. It's been part of a general attack by the government and law enforcement authorities against racketeering and corruption that's poisoning the whole nation. I'm talking about efforts against in the stock market, against defense contractors, against big corporations. And part of that has been a drive against organized crime in the labor movement. And by the way, if you want a full account of this, get Professor Jim Jacobs' book. I don't know if you have it on sale here.
No, I don't have it.
No, I'm talking about your book, yeah. In which he reviews the entire experience of the government in their RICO suits against unions. Yeah. Someone's holding it up right there. That's the story right there. It's a full analysis of all the trusteeships and monitorships by the U.S. government against corruption and racketeering in the labor movement. Now, for a while, that campaign was announced by some, the campaign by the government against racketeering in the labor movement, as part of the drive by a reactionary government to destroy or to curb the labor movement. This kind of argument has come from really two sources. One has been from the right, from the racketeers or their spokesmen on the one hand, who sort of become kind of born against Marxists when this question comes up, when they say you can't trust the government. You can't trust the government. And they do it, of course, in order to get the government off their back. But the other comes from good, sincere, devoted unionists, sort of from the left, who say you can't trust the government to do anything for labor. You can't trust the government. Now, I agree completely. You cannot trust the government. And I would add, nobody trusts the government, or at least very few people trust the government. If you took a poll of all the people in the United States, I think 75%, I think I'm being conservative, 75% would say you can't trust the government. But think of it, the Republicans have made a political career about you can't trust the government, right? They don't trust the Democrats. The Democrats don't trust the Republicans. The president doesn't trust Congress. Congress doesn't trust the president. The FBI doesn't trust the CIA, which isn't quite trusted by the Pentagon, and so on and so on and so on. The labor movement doesn't trust the NLRB. It doesn't trust the defense. Nobody trusts anybody. In fact, about the time I show you a New York Times had a big front page with arrows all over the place about which people in government who don't trust one another and the charges they make against one another. So that is true. You cannot trust the government, and that, you know, in that we're in line with the mainstream America. But that doesn't, the problem is that doesn't tell you what to do. Because even though we don't trust the government, we go to the government to do things for us. You may not trust the police, but yet you demand that they come and they help you to get rid of racketeers or stop you from being attacked by some hoodlums. So the very fact that you can't trust government only tells you that whatever you do, you should do it prudently. And I would agree that with that completely. Now, even though we can't trust the government, and when the government has gone in to do something about unions, there's a wide range of results. From pretty good and even very good on the one hand to an absolute disaster on the other hand, we're going to hear in the next session on from both of them, from someone who was in the most disastrous one to people who have been in some with the best results. But one thing I think you have to say, that good or bad, there hasn't been one case that I know of where the government came in, and when it left, the union was worse off than it was before. I don't know of any case like that. There have been cases where the government failed, but they failed because they did not act vigorously enough against the cruddy elements in the labor movement. Now, the main successes that we have had in this whole range of experience, and I'm talking now about the last almost 40 years, the places where we have had the greatest success in the drive against crooked and autocratic elements in the labor movement have been the cases where the power of the rank and file and the power of the government were combined in order to get a result. The power of the rank and file workers plus the power of government has been an effective force in helping to refurbish the labor movement. That's something that I believe very, very, very strongly. In the case, just to give you three fast cases, in the case of the United Mine Workers Union, it was because the Miners for Democracy, a powerful insurgent movement in the Miners Union, was able to get the power of government intervention through court decisions, which gave them the right to a fair and absolutely honest election, enabled them to sweep out a murderous union officialdom. When I say murderous, a president of the union who was finally convicted of murdering the leader of the insurgent movement. The other one was in the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Union, where it's still under a monitorship now for after about 15 years or more. But there, with the power that was given to them, or at least the defense of their rights, the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, which started out as a small, embattled, isolated movement, which finally got one person at a convention to be shouted down, has emerged now as a formidable force throughout the Teamsters Union. And that's because the power of the the rights of the insurgent movement has been protected by the power of the federal government. And right here, what we have today, take Ed Steer in Local 560. Ed Steer, I think, was there for about 15 years, 13 12. Years? 12 12. Years. All right, 12 years. Ed Steer was the, but there in Local 560, empowered by a court order as an official government trustee with the rights of subpoena, the whole works, he was able to transform that union, get rid of one of the worst mob-dominated unions in the United States. The union that was run by Tony Provenzano, where at least two insurgent leaders were murdered, and others were, one guy had his skull cracked with a hammer, and Tony Provenzano, who is one of the leading suspects in the murder of Jimmy Hoffa, that union was transformed because Ed Steer took all this time in order to encourage people to come from within the union and protected their rights for over this 12 years so that they could come and finally, in the end, get rid of this corrupt union leadership. So, in short, what the message that I want to bring, and I hope that this conference brings, is that if you want to get rid of racketeers and build a good union, we need the power of union reformers backed by the power of government. And if you live here just thinking about that and keeping it in mind for the future, this conference will have been a success. Thank you.
I'd like now to introduce Professor Jim Jacobs, who's professor at New York University School of Law, who worked for years with Governor Cuomo's Organized Crime Task Force, and who has, Herman has mentioned, the author of Mobsters, Unions, and Feds, which assesses federal efforts in this area. Jim Jacobs.
Well, good morning, and it's really a great honor to be on a program this morning with Herman Benson and Ed Steer. And I don't want to embarrass them, but I really feel like you probably all agree with me. These are two of the greatest men that I've ever met. Not only their energy and their idealism and their commitments, but their personal courage as well. So I'm just a scribbler. And I'm trying to document and make sense of much of the work and the initiatives that they have undertaken, and look at the consequences. And that's a big job. Herman pretty much says it all, but I'll try to underline a couple of the points. I'll speak from the perspective of the. Of the government's efforts against organized crime, because I think that's where all this starts. We have a almost a unique kind of organized crime problem in the United States that began to show itself in the early 20th century and became the organized crime families and the Italian-American organized crime families in particular, became so powerful during Prohibition, and then became entrenched in politics, in business, and in labor after Prohibition. It's something that is well known and yet not known at the same time. Often we tell ourselves kind of fairy tales about American history and American democracy, but the truth is that during the entirety of the 20th century, the organized crime families were at the table of power in at least in the urban centers throughout the United States, and they were closely allied with the political machines, with business, and with labor, and they also very significantly influenced and infiltrated law enforcement at the same time in many places for much of the century. This is a very, very formidable crime syndicate, and it's left a tremendous legacy on our institutions and on our culture. That syndicate was pretty much unopposed, you know, with some few exceptions, until well into the 1970s. And so it was really allowed to develop, allowed to become more and more entrenched and to exploit its power. But the government did not take on these organized crime families in any significant way until the 1970s. And likewise, the labor movement didn't take them on. There was a few bits of effort and noise from time to time, but basically the labor movement learned to live, or had to learn to live and adapt to the presence and the exploitation of these crime families, and so did the so did urban politics in the United States. And it really seems to me a fascinating fact that we developed our democracy in the 20th century. It evolved in the 20th century, along with the existence of these crime syndicates in the major cities of the United States, and those syndicates generated their influence beyond just the cities. They generated influence regionally and even nationally. The situation began to change, and I've been writing a lot about this, how it changed and why it changed, and it's a complex story. I think the change occurred as a slow evolution. You could see it in the McClellan Committee hearings from 1957 to 1959. It had something to do with the Appalachian Convention of the Organized Crime Bosses in 1957. It certainly had something to do with Robert Kennedy being the U.S. Attorney General from 1961 to 1964, and Robert Kennedy for the first time focusing the Justice Department on organized crime. But interestingly enough, he had his focus was on organized crime and on labor racketeering and labor corruption and Jimmy Hoffa, as you know. So he saw this connection, but I don't think he understood it and appreciated it very deeply. I mean, I don't think enough was known at that time. But the important point, I think, to me, for our purposes here, is that the government, as Herman said, it developed its attack on organized crime in the early 1970s, with the after Hoover died and the changes in the FBI. Organized crime became the focus, and the first focus was to do something about gambling, and when that proved not to be successful, they began to look for what other ways is there to attack this organized crime syndicate, and they began to focus on organized crime's power base in the unions, and it was a significant power base in the unions. So they followed organized crime into the unions, and this, I think, was purely motivated, right, by the desire within the FBI and within the Department of Justice to eliminate the affront to those agencies and to the nation of these organized crime syndicates, these organized crime figures who operated openly and basked in reputation and power openly throughout the United States. One anecdote: when I arrived at the University of Chicago Law School in 1970, and we were treated to a bus tour of the city of Chicago. The person running the tour, as we entered the loop, said, "This is Chicago's first ward. This is the mafia's ward." And look around, and there they are. And they're guys in black shirts and white ties, and they're standing in front of various places. And no one seemed to think, what? This is Chicago? This is Second City? What do you mean this is the mafia's ward, the center of Chicago? That's the way it was. So the story we're telling here is not just a story of a problem in the labor movement. We're talking about a deep structural, political, social problem throughout the United States. And to me, as I've been working on this on and off for over 20 years, what is truly remarkable is that we've done anything about it. We could really think it's amazing that a country could take on that much of the power structure. I mean, there are very few countries which do that. I mean, Japan has an organized crime situation similar to ours, and they don't take it on, right? Italy, of course, has attempted to do something, and with results that are not nearly as profound as the results in the United States. The problems in Russia now are well known. The problems in Colombia. You think about what it takes to go after a force that is part of the power structure of the country that exerts influence right up to the White House and right through Congress and so forth. So it's really quite remarkable that beginning in 1970s, we began these prosecutions of the organized crime bosses, and then in 1982, the first of the civil RICO cases, the one that Ed Steer was involved with and led in New Jersey, where the government used the racketeering laws to get an injunction to prevent further racketeering within those unions, and assigned a trustee to the job to purge organized crime and try to create an environment that would resist re-penetration by organized crime in the years to follow. There have been 21 of these suits, which I document in my book. Four of them against the whole international unions, as you probably know all this, and 17 against locals or district councils. And the influence of these lawsuits radiates beyond just those 21, because each of the certainly the international ones has generated international trusteeships, dozens of them in the Teamsters and the laborers unions and so forth. So we are experiencing from the 1980s till now a profound and sustained attack on organized crime, which has been extremely successful, not just in the labor unions, but in the dozens and hundreds of prosecutions of organized crime figures, so that we're making it a very precarious occupation to be an organized crime boss or an organized crime capo. And I don't need to remind you. Maybe I do need to remind you. If you look back a generation, it wasn't risky to be an organized crime boss. You said, "Well, who's the boss here in New Haven or in Providence or in Boston, in Youngstown, Ohio, in Cleveland?" People say, "Oh, so and so is the boss. You know, he's always been the boss, right? Because he had a predecessor boss and so forth." Nothing happens to these people, and that has truly changed. In the last 20 years, right, where some organized crime families in the country have been practically eliminated, and all of these organized crime families have been substantially weakened. And we are dealing with a remarkable, unprecedented kind of law enforcement attack, of which the RICO suits are part. So when the government went after the labor racketeers, they were going after the organized crime figures and their allies in the labor unions, trying to cut off their money and their power and their influence. They did not have some kind of vision of union democracy. They did not have some kind of motive of cleaning up the unions and changing unions in America. I don't think that that was part of the goals. I don't think it was part of the knowledge base. This attack didn't come from the Department of Labor. Didn't come from the Department of Commerce. This came from the Justice Department. These people are crime fighters. You know, they have organized crime people's pictures on their walls, right? That's the target. You know, that's how they're going to make their reputations. And they're not, most of them have no particular views one way or the other about the labor movement. Or if they do, they're very friendly, as far as I know, towards the labor movement. Often we talk about the government, right, coming into the labor movement. And we need to create a more nuanced view of that. I mean, the government, you know, talk about, you know, what Herman said, the Sixth Army or something, right? I mean, the government coming into the labor unions, you know, is Ed Steer, right? And people like Ed, a former prosecutor, sometimes a former FBI agent, appointed as a trustee, given usually on a part-time basis, given a budget, having a few assistants, right? And they are there trying to find out what happened, to do some more investigation, get rid of some bad guys, do some auditing of the books and records, right? But this is not some behemoth, you know, the government, right? This is a few people, right, working part-time, right, with a limited knowledge base for many of them, and with remarkably, in some of these cases, very limited understanding of the depths of the problems or about what to do. And the problems are deep, and they're complicated, and they're entrenched. There is no, clearly, but one thing we can conclude from the efforts up till now, there's no one-size-fits-all solution. The problem is different in different industries, in different unions, with different ethnic compositions, with different histories, right? And the different trustees have had different kinds of power. They've had different kinds of energy, different kinds of resources at their disposal. Sometimes the FBI has been willing to help. Sometimes it hasn't been there. They've had to scrape along, but the image of the government being in the union, reshaping the union, that needs to be corrected. We don't have the government. We have a few private lawyers who had previously been in the government working as trustees and reporting to the court. I mean, that's the model. And we have some federal judges, busy federal judges who are more or less involved because all of these cases except one was concluded by a settlement. The judge didn't get so involved in the case, right? I mean, didn't see all the witnesses and so forth. Maybe didn't take ownership of the case, right? So we've got a federal judge. We've got these trustees. I agree with Herman that, as I say in the book, many, maybe even most of these trusteeships have not been 100% successful, not even been substantially successful. There have been a few really important successes, of which Local 560 is one, but many of them have not been successful, but none of them have made the situation worse, and all of them have helped to weaken the organized crime syndicates. So I think when the smoke lifts and when we look back at this history and ask what's achieved, I think we'll be able to say that in the end of the 20th century, a remarkable attack on a remarkable crime syndicate was mounted in the United States, was sustained even in the face of a lot of entrenched political and social and economic interests, was quite successful, and that within the labor movement it opened up a space. It opened up a possibility, right, for reformers, for Democrats, for with a small D, for rank and filers to take back their unions, to take over their unions, and to do some institution building in the union movement. That the purging of organized crime was a necessary precondition for that kind of institution building to happen, but it was not a complete condition, right? It was not sufficient, right? And as Herman says, you needed the government to rid the union of organized crime because you cannot topple an organization like that without the government and without prosecutorial assistance. It's just too powerful. But then you need to be sufficient. You need you need the union members themselves to reclaim their democracy. So in that way, the story is a lot like Iraq. You know, we can make a space. We can create a space where democracy is possible, right? But we can't create democracy. We can't impose good government on unions. That will have to be left to the unions themselves. And so, again, following Herman's wisdom, we need to create a marriage between union democracy advocates and the trustees who are operating these trusteeships, and they need to work together. I mean, this has got to be a hand-in-hand situation, because effective purging of organized crime opens the space. It allows for more people to come forward, right? It encourages people to come forward and play a role, and makes it more possible to do some institution building in democracy. And institution building in democracy helps to make the union resistant to organized crime and encourages people to cooperate in ferreting out the last elements of organized crime. But there are a lot of variables. There's no single blueprint. We haven't done nearly enough in the way of evaluation research. There have been far too few conferences like this one. And finally, it needs to be said that even if organized crime can be completely destroyed in the United States, which I think it can be, at least the traditional Italian-American organized crime families, that doesn't necessarily require a happy ending for labor unions and for labor corruption. I mean, there's a history of independent corruption not connected to organized crime that is not part of this overall attack over the last 20 years, although it has been touched from independently from time to time. But it's certainly possible that independent despots will emerge and with their own cliques in various unions, and that the life of an ordinary worker and rank and filer would not be much improved by the substitution of one set of corrupt officials by another corrupt official. So the window is open, but and it's given us a historic opportunity to do some institution building in union democracy, but it won't be open forever, and it could certainly, a conclusion could be a sad conclusion. The window closes, and we get another form of racketeering. Thank you.